Welcome to this week's episode of the Building Texas Show. I'm really excited to sit down with Greg Munster from Sendero Wealth Management and talk about philanthropy. And it's a topic that is very entrepreneurial at its core, but we're going to learn a lot around what does the word mean, how is it happening in Texas, and then where should generationally we be thinking about philanthropy? And I use the word philanthropy. I think some people might hear nonprofit. Can you help me understand? Is there a difference?
Well, there really is not a difference because philanthropy is the way to support nonprofit organizations. But what's interesting is when people think about philanthropy, they think about the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts, and they think of all these wealthy people that you read about in the Wall Street Journal and papers all the time. But philanthropy really is a very generic term that just means giving something away. And people automatically kind of gravitate towards what I'm giving away is my money. Mm-hmm. But if you looked up a definition of philanthropy, it really comprises three components, and absolutely treasure is one of them, but time and talent are also parts of philanthropy. So anytime you as an individual give away something in one of those categories, your time or your talent or your money, you're being a philanthropist. You know, and as I was thinking about what we would talk about today, you kind of sit back and look at the range of the population from the not so wealthy to the very wealthy, you know, and people at this end of the spectrum tend to think all the philanthropists are out here. And that's really not the case.
Yeah.
The philanthropy covers the entire spectrum of net worth, income levels, education levels, and so forth. And as I was thinking about that concept for this conversation, I kind of reflected back towards when I first got married. And my wife and I, you know, being early 20s, we didn't have any money. But after a few years, we had a lot of real-world experience. We had work experience. And we had something to give away to the nonprofit community, and it was time and talent. And so if you would have asked me back then, am I a philanthropist, I probably would have said no. But if you ask me today, was I a philanthropist back then? I will say absolutely. You know, so people shouldn't automatically think that money is what makes you a philanthropist. Money makes you a significant philanthropist, but time and talent really goes a long way towards helping. Like you said, what's the difference between philanthropy and a nonprofit? Time and talent go a long way to making a nonprofit successful.
I so appreciate that clarity, because I think of the rural community, the nonprofits that are really distant from a bigger city. A lot of their philanthropists are time and talent. They are really rolling up their sleeves and giving everything they have to these organizations. And they're looking for the treasure piece, because you can't do any of this without all three. You can try, but you've got to have all three to be really successful.
Sure.
And so the assumption that money will make you successful, no. You have to have talent, time, and you have to have the people that are willing to do that. And that's the whole spectrum, too, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
You can't just have the money check writers coming in, because quite often they don't have the time to give, nor the operational talent that would be needed for whatever the mission might be at hand.
Sure. Well, you know, ideally, at some stage in your life, you've got the ability and the resources to give all three.
Okay.
But if you think about the reality of, let's call it, smaller towns or rural communities, finding people who have the time to give you what you need becomes difficult, just because the population is smaller.
Yep.
You know, one of the family foundations that I work with is in McMullen County.
Okay.
A county. You know, when you think of Texas and you think of all the counties, You know, everything's big in Texas. McMullen County is big. The entire population of McMullen County is 3,000 people.
Yep.
So how many of them need services and how many of them are available to give services, it becomes really difficult to fill the time and talent portion of philanthropy. Now, that happens to be in the middle of the Eagle Ford Shale, so the treasure part of it is a little easier to accomplish. But if you ask me what's the most difficult part of being a nonprofit organization in a smaller town or a rural county, I would say finding people to help, yep, either in a volunteer capacity to deliver the service or to be on a board of directors.
And that's quite often two very different personalities and skill sets. You can be a great volunteer, but not necessarily be the right person for a board.
Yeah.
You can be the right person for the board, but maybe not necessarily the right volunteer for whatever that might be. But what I hear also coming in is phases and stages of life. You need an age mix because, as you described, your wife and you early in your career, in your marriage, you were able to give time and talent, but not treasure. But you were showing up in your late 20s, early 30s, doing that work. And that prepared you for later in life to do all three in a lot of ways. So when I'm looking at this, I think about board development a lot. We are always looking for volunteers for these organizations. And we're looking for board members for these organizations. But I know you and I share a passion for how do we develop those people to be the right person for where they are. Mm-hmm. So they can come into an organization and be successful, not stretched to be a board member when they're not ready, and not pulled down to be front line if that's not where they're going to really bring the most to the organization. It's a long-winded way, but you have to have all three, and I think a lot of that is the age and generational diversity too.
Yeah, I totally agree because you know, if you look at the age and generational differences, you've got people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Let me divide that even more, 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
They're likely married, likely with young children. The kids are in sports or music or whatever, or in the Bernie Little League.
Yeah, all the way to the World Series for
exactly.
2 weeks.
So, you know, if you ask a person in that age grouping to give much of their time, they're probably not really able
prepared
to do that.
Yeah.
So you move to the next phase, which might be 30, 40s. The kids are starting to get a little bit older and they might be a little more independent, but that person is potentially still working to build their career to try to, you know, make an impact on the company that they work for, the field of business that they're in. So there may be a little more available time, but there probably isn't a lot. So then you get to the next phase, which is the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Mm-hmm. You've got people that are either nearing retirement or newly retired, and they're looking for something to do. Why not motivate them and sort of educate them towards doing something for somebody else?
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily, what am I going to do with my time to benefit me or my wife or, you know, my family?
Yeah.
You know, think about how can you use the skills and knowledge you've developed over the last 50, 60 years to make an impact on the nonprofit community? Because let's face it, now your company, Das Greenhouse, is really focused on incubating companies to grow and become successful. So the people who come to your shop are entrepreneurs.
Yep.
So if you really think about it, the person who runs a nonprofit organization, they're entrepreneurs also.
They are.
When I was getting ready to retire from banking, which was 7 years ago, and before I ended up going into the philanthropy world with Sendero, I had thought about becoming an executive director of a nonprofit organization. But then I started thinking about the nuts and bolts of running a nonprofit organization. And one of the things that scared the heck out of me is if your budget, if you don't have money in the bank, if your budget is tight, how do you meet payroll every 2 weeks? I think an entrepreneur, a person who's officing in your facility and is trying to grow their business, at some point is going to have exactly the same worries. You know, at my stage in life, do I want to worry about meeting payroll? No. But so I think the comparison between a business entrepreneur and a nonprofit leader is they're very similar.
They are. And in that instance, we see a lot of nonprofits come through Dust Greenhouse looking for resources and looking for ways to think differently about what they've been doing for a long time. Some of these organizations, and we're very grateful and have the opportunity to live in the most giving county in Texas. Kendall County has nearly 500 nonprofits, has a lot of activity happening, and we have people that are giving back. When they're giving, it's not always locally. I recognize people give internationally, and so that can look very different. But when I think of the size and scale of 500 nonprofits, let's just assume they need the minimum of 3 board members each. That's 1,500 people that are now actively engaged in our nonprofit world. But at varying levels on a spectrum, there's also duplicated services. There's also nonprofits that are living on a thread, and it's a payroll, and it's really having a negative quality of life on the founder that's tried to do it. Very similar to a business startup for profit. Sometimes it's a bad idea. And you've got to be able to fail fast. Nonprofits, sometimes it's something you're doing because you're passionate, something happened in life, and it's causing you to really go run. And I see a lot of those founders come in, and I want to pause them and say, who's solving this problem already? Who's serving this community or need? Where can we take that activation where you want to go out and really start it up and you're going to do it, and put it to work in a place where you can be plugged into a process and a place of impact that you can really make the impact you want to make, but not have to solve all the problems of having a nonprofit. And I say problems, they're opportunities, but you don't get the equity. You don't own a nonprofit. A board manages the nonprofit, and then there's a legal flow of cash that happens. You can't necessarily increase salaries and do all the things that a for-profit business would do when they need to, because you're subject to rules, restrictions, bylaws, lots of bureaucracy in some cases, that if you're not equipped to fully understand or have a board that's really guiding, can be a very treacherous day in the life of.
Absolutely. You know, if you're running a business once you're well-established and you're either selling a product or a service, you just increase, you raise the prices.
Yeah.
That's you know, we're in the middle of an inflationary environment right now. If you're running a nonprofit organization, if I was sitting at your desk and someone walked in and said, how do I do this? The first question I would ask is, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And if there isn't passion, they're doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Because passion will drive a lot of success. I suspect in the business world, entrepreneurial business world as well, you know, if you don't have passion for your product or your the computer program that you're putting together, or
whatever it might be,
you're bound to fail. So, you know, like you said, the founder may have had an experience in their own family, whether it was either an illness or a handicapped child or something that created passion in them, and that's a great starting point, but it's not the only starting point, and it's not the major consideration that you have to think about, because once you've addressed why am I doing this, then the bigger question is, how do I do it? And that's why you need a board of directors. And you don't need, you know, a lot of times, I've been on many boards over the years where when it's board rotation time and the chair of the board will say, I want each of you to to give me the name of somebody that might be a good board member.
Yeah.
Well, what ends up happening in those cases, you know, I look at my friends and my sphere of influence and the people that I associate with, and I tend to nominate one of them. Well, what ends up happening, if everybody on the board is doing that, what we're doing is proliferating my philosophy, their philosophy, and the best boards are made up of people with diverse backgrounds, diverse educations, diverse work experiences, and frankly, whether you want to accept it or not, diverse philosophies.
Yeah.
So if you think about those problems and then you place that in a smaller community, now, and Bernie is becoming a bigger community, yeah. You know, but if you think about Bandera, Comfort, some of the other smaller towns, boy, it gets really difficult to find people who fit into those categories who aren't like me,
yeah.
if you know what that means.
Yeah. And then to have the worldly experience, because in some of these places, when you get out of, Bernie's very fortunate, a lot of people retire here. So they're coming at a stage in life where they can get involved, they can match the whole spectrum of need, time, talent, treasure. But that's not the case for every town in Texas. McMullen County is not getting an influx of Houstonian retirees.
Correct.
But their need is very significant. They have the food security needs, I'm certain. They have broadband digital access need. They have pet rescues. Those all require the same level of energy to meet the governance of a nonprofit and then just to keep it moving and keep donors excited.
Yeah.
But then you work into donor fatigue as well. And that's the inflationary market that we're in right now. Donations for a lot of people can be a quick line cut. And so now our nonprofit leaders run into a whole new set of macro challenges that what tools, what levers, what do they look at? And when I'll keep using the example of McMullen. When you're out there, there's not as many levers as when you're in a city center like San Antonio. Mm-hmm. So what do you do and how do you keep that excitement going? How do you keep the volunteer, perpetual volunteer, how do you level them up or insert new energy into an organization?
Yeah. Actually, the second part is easier than the first part. You know,
okay.
You know, how do you keep the enthusiasm and the interest, you know, and that's through things like training and board development so that, you know, you keep them on top of the spectrum of what's going on in the nonprofit world. And, you know, that boils down to having people available to help expand the education base of someone who's serving as a board member. You know, the more difficult part is if the community is a small enough population, finding the people who have more so at this point the time and the talent, because at some point treasure will come along, but the reality is whenever I recruit board members, and I tell them what their time expectations are, I also tell them you do have to make a monetary contribution, even if it's small, because nonprofit organizations get their money from, in some cases, government grants, in more cases from private philanthropists like the foundations I work, the Kelso Foundation, the Wheeler Foundation, and several others, but then from individuals. Well, when a nonprofit organization comes to us, one of our foundations, and looks for money, one of the questions I always ask them is, does everybody on your board support you? I never ask how much.
Yeah.
But if a board member who is chartered, as you said earlier, with governance and strategic planning, if the people who are governing the organization don't also have skin in the game, then why should I support them? Why should I encourage my foundation trustees to support an organization when half of the board members don't?
Yeah.
So, you know, There's a lot of critical elements. It's really easy to say, I'm going to set up a nonprofit organization, and I've got three people that I'm going to put on the board.
Which is the state minimum, just for everybody to know.
Exactly. And frankly, I think that's...
bare minimum.
It's inadequate.
Yeah.
Because even if it's not a startup nonprofit organization, if it's an organization that's been around for 10 or 15 years and you have three board members, everybody's doing all the work.
Yep.
And the reality is, in most boards that I've ever been affiliated with, and I use the example many times that I can divide a board into three segments, a third, and a third. Mm-hmm. This third does 90% of the work. This third does 10% of the work, and this third just shows up.
Yep.
So the bigger your board becomes, you not only have to worry about time, talent, and treasure, you have to worry about, am I picking the right people who are going to do the right thing and help me? Because that's the job of a board member, is to help the organization. So keep coming back to this smaller town, and your math saying that a town with 500 nonprofits might need 1,500 people.
It really needs a lot more.
That's a big job, exactly.
Yeah. And I appreciate what you just said, because in these organizations, and let's just keep talking about the rural versus a bigger city, in the smaller town, the skills development for the staff is different too. And there's a lot to be said about having good processes, good marketing, good storytelling that's going to engage and convert donors, supporters, whatever it might be. But your board really has to have outside influence in developing. They mm-hmm. have to bring that time, because they are, in theory, leading the strategy and the vision and the operational elements. Sometimes, if you're an operating board or you're a governing board, there can be a difference there. But even in a governing board, you have a hand in strategy. You set an expectation of operational excellence. Mm-hmm. But you have to have the skill sets to do that. And it gets real thin the further out, the smaller the population, the more organizations there are on really moving that needle.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a good point. And frankly, when you divide boards into an operating board versus a governing board, the preponderance of nonprofit boards are governing boards, not mm-hmm. operating boards. You know, so the skills and the knowledge and the expertise that a governing board has to have become pretty significant, because not only are they responsible for the sustainability of the organization, and the ongoing concern of the organization as a business, because mm-hmm. it is a business, even though it's called a nonprofit or a not-for-profit organization. The people that you get on that board have to be connected in the community as well. So do you want an introvert on the board? Not unless they're a genius and they know strategic planning backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
But for the most part, when you're recruiting board members, you want people that have influence in the community, have connections, so that if we're doing a gala or a golf tournament, don't make the staff rely on filling the tables and selling the sponsorship kinds of things. So there's a lot of complexities that go into being a board member. And the biggest mistake that I see people who have never been on a board make is they say something like, you know, pick an organization, the Red Cross. And they say, I want to help communities that are impacted by a disaster. And so my passion is doing that. Well, what do you know about disaster relief? Well, not a whole lot. Yeah. Well, what do you know about raising money to help those communities? Well, not a whole lot. How many people do you know that might have the resources to help you help the Red Cross? You know, so it becomes, if you make a decision to get involved with the nonprofit community based on a passion or an idea, that's that much. It's the tip of the iceberg. And you need all that stuff below the waterline to really be an effective board member.
In as much as we're trying to talk about developing the board member, I want to go back to where we started around philanthropy. It's a mindset. It is a commitment. There's a discipline to it. And as we expand generationally, it becomes a challenge for families of means. That how do you instill that philanthropic culture into future generations? How do we teach that in schools, churches, other activities?
Yeah.
There's a core principle that I think we had differently, maybe even 30 years ago than today. And I don't think that's an ageism thing. I don't want to put that on those buckets, but it really is how you've experienced the world, what you've been introduced to, and where you understand your ability to impact.
Yeah.
So Sendero's made an investment in somebody like you to come in and help people understand that in a much bigger way. And I want to do justice. You've been doing banking for a long time, supporting financial institutions for almost 50 years, but you've been in the philanthropic part of that equally as long. And I just know it's part of your personality. Like, your ethos is philanthropy. And then it's backed by experience and wisdom gained in a banking career. So you come in with an interesting lens of having seen the financial world and understanding how people impact and live in that world. But then some do it really well, where they're setting up the organizations that they believe in the mission. Yeah. They're setting up for 3-4 generations of support. But I wouldn't know what that looks like. I wouldn't even know where to begin to say, how do I plan to help this organization that I love for years to come? Oh, by the way, that means they need to be sustainable. They need to have processes and policies. And as much as I'm going to give to them, I'm also going to make sure they're doing that? Or am I just giving and saying it's going to sort out?
Well, you know, you've actually taken that conversation two different directions.
No.
You know, one of the directions is passing on family values,
mm-hmm.
and dealing with the next generations. And I can talk about that for a minute or two. But then you talk about sustainability and other kind of concepts that are important to the nonprofit community. The issue of families is always interesting. I mean, everybody who's going to watch this can tell you family stories about very cooperative families and dysfunctional families and things like that. And when you work with families who have substantial resources, the families that have had the easiest time passing on their values are the ones where mom and dad or grandpa have basically shown by example.
Yep.
You know, grandpa was on the board of the Red Cross, to use that again, for 20 years. Grandma was on the board of the Assistance League for 20 years. Mom and dad have kind of picked up the mantle, and they're now involved in the Boys and Girls Club or some other nonprofit organization. So you can't underestimate the value of leading by example to have it passed down to multiple generations, even though you're going to deal with the different values and the psychology and the motivations of 4 generations of people. One of the things that we do in philanthropy at Sendero, in addition to helping families give away their money, yep. is we do legacy planning, which has really been interesting to be involved in, because we've seen a lot of cases where grandma and grandpa or mom and dad were philanthropic, but they wrote checks. And the next generation or 2 generations down didn't see that. So, you know, now that they're nearing the end of their life, or at least the end of their ability to make philanthropic decisions, they want to start passing their values down. to the next generation and the third generation and so forth. And the best way to do that is with some organized legacy planning. You know, so you sit down with the family and you have grandma and grandpa or mom and dad, whoever's leading the charge at that particular point, talk about what's important to them, what are their values, and ask the kids. And I use the term kids loosely because that could be a 25-year-old.
Yeah.
But, you know, once you get to be my age, everybody's a kid.
Yeah.
But then you ask the kids, what are your values? And they spend time talking about the differences and have this generation, grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, understand the kids' values and have the kids understand mom and dad's value. And it takes a lot of time to work through legacy planning so that, you know, at some point when grandma and grandpa are gone and they have supported nothing but national organizations, and I'm not being specific. And now the kids, the third generation, says, well, I understand the needs of national organizations, but Bernie, Bandera, Kerrville, Fredericksburg, Bergheim, Comfort, we have different needs than what the national organizations need. So even though you set up this foundation or this trust thinking you're going to help national organizations, now that you're gone, I'm going to take this a completely different direction. There's a lot that goes into exploring those values and coming to some kind of agreement so that, you know, it's real easy to sit back and say, for crying out loud, it's my money.
Yeah.
And here are my values, and I want you to support my values. But the reality is, once I'm gone and somebody else is in charge, the definitions change. And so you go from leading by example, and then and everybody says, I want to be just like my grandpa or my dad, to having to spend a lot of time working through legacy planning. And it's a difficult process. It takes time.
It's work. And what I just heard is a similar conversation if I had a piece of property and multiple children and who's going to do what. It's the same type of estate planning. You want to avoid the next generation fighting about it, causing bigger concern. But philanthropic, like I couldn't tell you what my grandparents were philanthropic about because it wasn't a conversation that we were having at the Christmas table or at the dinner table for that matter.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that there are people doing that, and it's been eye-opening to me that it's so much more than galas and auctions and peer-to-peer fundraising. When you get into these legacy giving opportunities, and there's some big names in our region that have just had 50 years of impact that we can think of, but those are very intentional. I think of there's individual leaders, and they're in the news right now, but that one person not being able to give the impact that they've been giving for 30 years is going to hit so many organizations if they hadn't done the planning with somebody like you around how do I continue to make an impact, whether it's through my kids or next generation or it's through planned giving after I've passed.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's a lot of good financial planners out there.
Mm-hmm.
I work for Sendero. I think they're one of the best, but there are a lot of financial planning organizations, and it takes skill to kind of work your way through that legacy conversation, and it takes a lot of experience, and, you know, gray hair gives you a lot of experience, but family dynamics are always going to enter into the equation, and there's a lot of strategies. There's a lot of things that go into the process. You used the example of galas and golf tournaments and so forth. An easy thing is if I'm buying a table for a benefit for a cause that's important to me, and I've got a 30-year-old son who's married, bring him to the table.
Yeah.
Have him be one of my guests at the table. some of his friends. Instead of inviting all of my friends, which could be beneficial because they're going to write bigger checks, but you know, bringing family members into activities like galas, having them participate in a golf tournament with you, or some other kind of a fundraiser at pickleball, or you know, you name it. So there's a lot of strategies out there. All you got to do is think about them.
I've seen employers take a similar stance too, getting their up and coming employees to come to the table and to be introduced to the corporate responsibility that we have. I think of the brands in our region that do carry a lot of the philanthropic media, at least. They're getting a lot of publicity for what they do.
Yeah.
I don't think that's why they do it, but they're just visible in how they give.
Yeah.
That to me is similar to a family, and you're raising that culture. You're raising those employees to be employees that will continue to meet the strategy and direction of that organization.
Yeah.
And so I think of a family foundation or family office. Similarly, corporate structures, you've got some bounds, but it's if you don't instill it as part of that employee culture or that family culture, it can easily be diluted and lost.
Yeah, and you know, United Way campaigns try to do that when they do their annual appeals, and they come into companies and they talk to them. But when they do that, what the United Way does, and I totally support the United Way, but you know what they're really trying to do is get me as an employee to give my money to the United Way that then they can distribute to a cause. What I think is, and it's a great process, but what I think is even more effective, that kind of gets to the point that you just mentioned, one of the things we do at Sendero is we give every employee, we don't give it to them, we tell every employee, we're going to allocate some money to you.
Yeah.
And you tell us who to write the check to. So even though we have secretaries who make $30,000 a year, maybe single parents with two or three kids, they don't really have resources themselves to be philanthropic. They do have time, and they might have some talent to offer. But my company has told them, I want you to think about philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm giving you X number of dollars. How do you want us to spend it?
What a great feedback loop. I imagine you find new causes, new organizations, new layers of support.
Ones you never hear of, yeah. Because they're neighborhood ones, maybe. And they're ones that they know about and that they're familiar with.
They're solving a need in their community.
Exactly.
I've never had somebody explain that a company would do that. I've seen corporate matching programs and things like that. But to give a balance to somebody to create that culture is really something to applaud.
You know, and one of the other things that I've been working with some of our families, some of our clients at Sendero with, who have come to us and said, how do I instill a sense of philanthropy in my kids when I really haven't been philanthropic until I sold my business?
Yeah.
Which is what all your Das Greenhouse clients ultimately want to do. And what I've routinely suggest to them is when they've got some resources, you have four kids, allocate $10,000, pick a number, $1,000.
Yeah.
Pick a number and tell each of your kids, you've got to do some research and tell me who you want your allocation to go to. And you know what I think that's done is helped those families get their kids to start thinking about, okay, if it's $1,000, you know, I give $100 or $250. But if it's $10,000, I'm going to pick four charities to give $2,500 to. Who are they?
Yeah.
And it forces the kids to start thinking beyond their world of their schools, their friends, their sports, their music programs. It's another way to start instilling some philanthropy in a younger generation.
I applaud the actionable direction there because I do see we get the opportunity to see all walks of life come through Das Greenhouse, live in our community, and to have a simple way, because it could be $100, it could be $50, $10.
Exactly.
But I went through that exercise with my parents when it was a paper exercise, it wasn't real money, but it was, hey, let's pick a stock. And I was 8 years old. Let's pick a stock and we're going to watch it and we're going to learn about finance that way. But in my family system, it wasn't necessarily, hey, we're going to think about this balance. Where would you give? And I could see that being a really interesting dinner conversation for a family to think about. Where would their 5-year-old consider giving? Where would their 15-year-old consider giving? Because it comes back to their experience, what they've seen, how they interpret need in their world.
Yeah.
And that's an important lens to give people, give kids.
Well, and interestingly, you mentioned 5-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, what does a 5-year-old think about? One of the things that we have and we give to families with younger kids is we have a piggy bank.
Yeah.
It's a plastic piggy bank, so you can see what's in it, but it's got 3 or 4 slots in the top, and it's divided into sections. So you give a 5-year-old kid $1 allowance,
yep,
give it to him in quarters, and she puts a quarter in, I'm going to spend this,
mm-hmm,
puts a quarter in the savings, puts a quarter in a church contribution. I'm just making this up because I don't remember what all 4 of them are, but there's a slot for charity.
Yep.
And so you can start for really young kids by getting your hands on something like that when you're giving a kid an allowance and telling them, don't be selfish. Don't spend all this on yourself. Here are some opportunities. Save some, because you may want to buy something for $1 today, but you may want to buy something for $5 in a couple of months. If it's in that savings section, then I'm giving them the opportunity to spend more later on. But that's kind of a neat way to work with very young kids, is visually give them a piggy bank that's divided into quadrants.
You can see it. You can feel it. One of the issues I have with digital currency, it really, you've lost that touch and feel that a 5-year-old can really associate $1 to that. And then the action of putting it in different slots, I could see that being very powerful.
Yeah.
In a simple way to start teaching gratitude and impact.
Yeah. The long and the short of it is, and I don't know how much time left we have to go, but the long and the short of it is, philanthropy is important. It's important to the world. It's important to the United States. It's important to this community. And the earlier you can get folks involved in philanthropy, understanding that it's time and talent and treasure, or any combination of those three, the better off we're going to be, the better off Bernie's going to be, Kendall County. It's just something that ought to be on everybody's mind, no matter what kind of resources they have.
Absolutely. And top of my mind, and the last question I really want to dive into is, we've seen a lot of people move here, and they've moved here from primarily, let's say, Houston and California, just to keep it simple. I think more Houston, but that's my bend. How do you activate people that have moved? We move more than we did 50 years ago, mm-hmm, and we have people that they've risen in their career and they're at a stage in life where they have time, talent, and treasure, that sweet like 60-year-old age range where I've just sold my company, I'm retiring to the Hill Country, and I've been planning for 40 years, so I'm in a really great spot. Do they pick up their head and look locally when they move somewhere and say, how can I give locally? Because that is a concern I have specific for this county, because we do have that mix moving in, and they're still a little bit invisible. Yeah. It's easy to hide out, move here, hide out on a ranch, and not be engaged in the same way.
Yeah.
Now, I think they have a heart for it. I think they have well-established relationships back in their point of origin. But I want to encourage our nonprofits to meet them in the right way, too, and to say, we're a sophisticated organization. Here's what we're working on. all of the things that we've talked about through this conversation, it really becomes, how do you attract somebody to your local community when they move there and get them involved at the right place?
Well, like you said, if they're invisible and they want to be invisible,
it's hard.
You know, good luck. Yeah. Ideally, that person from California or Houston was already philanthropic.
Yeah.
And so once you're philanthropic, once you start feeling the joy of giving away money, because it is a happy, it makes you feel good to give away resources, time and talent as well. You want to continue doing that. You know, so if they've been philanthropic where they came from, they're going to seek out organizations. And whether it's, you know, through neighbors, word of mouth, a church, whatever, that part is easy. The other part is, and I'm not a marketing expert.
Yeah.
But the other answer is nonprofit organizations need to figure out a marketing campaign, and whether it's, you know, ads in the Bernie Star or billboards or flyers or unsolicited direct mail kinds of things, it's got to be marketing, and they've got to reach out to the whole community to identify those invisible people.
Yeah.
And get them engaged.
But when you do that, you have to talk about impact. I see organizations that have been doing it the same way for a long time. And I want to encourage those organizations to get really good at telling their own story.
Yeah.
Because quite often there's, oh yeah, we're just the people that do this. We've been doing it forever. And yes, they are, but there's a level of, you've been lulled into, everybody knows who we are, everybody knows what we do. But no, they don't. They've just moved here. They don't know who you are. They don't know that you're parents started this and that this is how the impact is. Nonprofit impact reports, philanthropic impact reports are key. How you write them, how you tell your story, to getting a sophisticated new resident to come in and potentially be that board member.
Yeah.
You have to show up and be able to speak the language that they're used to from the symphony in Houston or the San Diego Zoo that they've supported forever. I know both of those reports are going to be very full and written to long-term giving professionals in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Here, it's not always that, and I want to encourage that we can help with that.
Yeah, you know, if there's any way that you know, whether it's you or the chamber or whatever organization might be available to distribute impact reports.
Yeah.
That's important. If I'm going to write a check to an organization, I want to know whether they're serving 5 kids or 500 kids. So impact reports are really important. But what I think is even more important is for me to hear the story.
Yeah.
And I've talked with there's a Hill Country Lunch Bunch, and I've talked with them a couple of times, and I've told them, even when they write grants, because that's a little bit like trying to get, you know, Joe Gottrocks to write a check as well. You know, you can use all the jargon and the terminology and throw all kinds of numbers at them, at a group of trustees. But what really gets someone to listen is the story and tell a story of how you're impacting kids. Oh, by the way, we're impacting 500 kids, but here's how we're impacting them. So you've given them one statistic, but you've given them a lot of stories. And that's really, people really give from the heart. I went through a program several years ago called the Chartered Advisor in Philanthropy. And it's kind of like the financial planners and, you know, the estate planners and all that, but it's a philanthropic planners group. And they showed some statistics, and I pardon me for not remembering what they were, but they talked about people who give for above-the-line reasons and below-the-line reasons. And the difference is I sold my business. I made, pick a number, $20 million. I don't want to pay taxes on $20 million. And so how do I save taxes? You know, that's kind of the above the line. And I become philanthropic only because I want to save taxes.
Yep.
The preponderance of people, though, never really ask the tax-saving questions. They talk about, how can I make an impact now that I have all this money? Mm-hmm. How can I make an impact? And so most people of means, but not all, but most people of means, their heart's in the right place. And they understand philanthropy. They understand the causes and the needs in the community. So I just want to advise everybody to not automatically think the conversation is going to say, and if you give me $100, $75 of it's going to be tax deductible.
Yeah.
Do I appreciate tax deductions for the checks I write? Absolutely. Do I write the check because I'm getting a tax deduction? Not a single one.
Yeah. It is a symptom of really where you're giving and what you're doing. And you know that's the reality when you're giving to these organizations because it's a tax filing. Mm-hmm. But you're giving to them because they're telling their story well, they're compelling you to action, and they're making an impact. So I so appreciate the conversation. I always learn a lot from you when I sit down and talk to you. And Sendero doing some wonderful work and coming out and helping guide future generations of philanthropists is really important, impactful, and something I appreciate is you build Texas.
Happy to do it. Happy to build Texas. I'm not a native, but I've been here 31 years, and I feel like a native, and this is my home. I want to help you and the rest of the community build Texas.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. Mine too.